Everyone, and welcome to another episode of Double Shelix. I'm Kayla.
And I'm Sally. And today we are thrilled to welcome an extremely exciting and special guest, Dr. Sarah Kang, a scientist in the Complex In Vitro Systems Lab at Genentech. Today we're going to be talking all about Sarah's job hunt and job search process. And I'm really excited to have her because when I was in my 8-month-long plus stint of job searching, everyone I talked to, Sarah gave it to me straight at a time that I really needed it. And it was her advice that led me to the job that I have now. So Sarah, welcome to Double Shelix.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You know, we're really excited about this episode because it's the first one in a series of episodes about finding your job post-PhD. And another reason that we're really excited to have Sarah is that she has had experience applying for both a postdoc and industry job. So when you're having your internal conflicts about which direction you want to go, we can just add to that. Or maybe it will become abundantly clear by the end. I don't know. We're going to find out. Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about your background and what made you like, what were sort of your thoughts leading up to the end of your PhD and how you're going to go about your job hunt?
Sure, happy to. So I did my PhD at the University of California, Berkeley, jointly advised by the labs of Sanjay Kumar and Dave Schaefer, alongside you, Kayla.
Yes.
I would not have survived without you, but I digress. Same. So During my PhD, I spent a lot of time studying neural stem cells, biomaterials, and stem cells and stem cell biology. And as I was wrapping up my PhD, I was confronted with, you know, the same question that many people have when they're, you know, on their way out, which is, do I want to continue on the academic track that I've been on for 20 to 30 years of my life, or do I want to switch and make the jump to industry? At the time, I wasn't sure. So I shopped around for industry jobs that seemed to fit my experience and what I had been doing. And I quickly found that at the level of a new PhD during that time in my field, I didn't find a lot of positions that were really exciting to me. Many of the ones that I had seen were further away from research and further into the field of, you know, technical development or sales or consulting, which I have a lot of friends who have went there and have been very successful. But after all the time I had spent in research and how much I had loved doing the science, I really felt like what I wanted was something still that would allow me to ask questions and answer them on my own. At the same time, I was talking to my advisors and asking them about potential postdoctoral opportunities. And, you know, with the thought that maybe if I couldn't find a job here in my field right now, maybe after a little bit of a postdoc, I could find one that would offer the opportunities that I was looking for, in addition to gaining some skills that would help me make me both a more attractable candidate and also closer to the field that I wanted to end up in long term. The postdoc search was actually fairly quick on my end. And after a little bit of networking and talking to personal contacts, I ended up doing my postdoc at the Gladstone Institutes in the lab of Dr. Todd McDevitt.
You're considering which direction to go. You're not finding jobs that were in industry that were a good fit, but you were sort of thinking to go that direction long term. Is that true?
Or
you
were just kind
of on the fence?
I was very on the fence.
Okay.
Because I knew what I wanted to do was, you know, science and research, designing experiments and analyzing data, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to find a place where I could do it. And that more than academia or industry or the split between the two was my kind of driving force at the time. And so I made the decision to go for a postdoc rather than an industry position then, simply because it's what I wanted to do.
Yeah. And did you feel like going straight from PhD to an industry job would close that door, whereas staying in a postdoc would not?
I don't think I would say that I felt like it would close the door, mm-hmm. but I also don't think it would have gotten me much closer to it either. I felt like many of the opportunities that I had found or that I was looking at were going in different directions that would lead to development in different ways. There were very few, and certainly none that would take me, that led in the direction that, you know, I really wanted to take my career. Especially because if you look at some of the listings for, you know, positions like stem cell scientist or something that kind of fit where I ended up now, many of them would ask for at least industry experience or a postdoc. A postdoc was closest to what I had in mind. Might as well go there and make the best of it.
Yeah.
I would say, in our own conversation, Sarah, when I was in my job hunt, you really told it to me straight. You were like, look, it's really hard to get these positions at these large multinational companies as a scientist without a postdoc. And so that made me feel better about how long my search had gone this and not getting a position. But I would say that I think it depends on the company, because ultimately I did get a position as a scientist without a postdoc. It just took me a long time of unemployment when I could have been earning income as a postdoc. And now that you're in industry, do you feel like your experience as a candidate has held up? And do you feel like people need a postdoc to get to the position that you're in? Or do some people, are they able to figure out how to get it without a postdoc?
That's a really good question. And it brings up something I wanted to speak a little bit to, which is, I feel like your description is kind of lines up with how I think about it now, where there are positions like that available and there are opportunities, difficult as they may be to find, and it may often take a long time to find them. However, I do want to mention that, you know, this is maybe something that doesn't get talked about quite so much, which is that it can be hard to finish your PhD and be on the job search for a long time when you have no other source of income and or folks to support. And so the time pressure was definitely a part of my consideration as well. If I had kept going for months or a year, maybe I would have found something. You know, neither me nor my partner at the time, I guess now is my wife, were able to really support or sustain that for a long period of time. And so we kind of, you know, or I felt like I need to find something fast. I didn't have time to shop around quite so much.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's something that so often gets overlooked. When I was unemployed for 8 months, it was because I was still living in subsidized housing paid for by Berkeley. I still paid, but it was just reduced rent. And my husband was working at a startup company making a salary equivalent to, at the time, approximately 3 to 4 PhD salaries, PhD mm-hmm. student salaries. So we were plenty able to sustain that time and that long search. And that's definitely a privilege that not everyone can enjoy. And so I'm really happy that it worked out for you to like find this postdoc and use it as a bridge to where you want to be now.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to mention was, if you're in the position to, and as a piece of advice, if you're in the position to do this, definitely try to work together with your PI, start your search early, and have these conversations while you're still a grad student, or, you know, speak with your PI about maybe bridging that time with continued employment or a limited temporary postdoc. This is an option that gives you a lot more leeway and space to, you know, find something that feels like a good fit for you. If you're in a, you know, a lab and a position that allows you to do it, you know, I didn't think to do it. I didn't think that was an option. And also after 5.5 years, you're kind of like, you know, you want to go, but I definitely feel like, you know, I would have benefited from starting that earlier or talking about, you know, extending my stay to spend some more time looking.
On that note, 2 questions. Mm-hmm. One is, when did you start talking to your PIs? How did you go about it? I feel like I heard a lot of people be really nervous to have that conversation, which is always surprising to me because your PI should know that you're going to leave eventually, but also I get it because power hierarchy. So how did you have those conversations? When did you start it? When do you wish you would have started having those conversations? And then let's talk more after that about the timeline of actually applying.
Yeah, definitely. I actually started speaking to my PI about leaving fairly early, actually. So it was around my fourth year. And so this was a time where some of my research projects had begun to wrap, and we were writing our first manuscript. When we had kind of finished most of the writing and were working on submitting it and that whole paper writing process, that is around when I brought up to them, you know, the idea of this is a complete body of work. Let's talk about what else I might need to do before I'm out of here. And when I spoke to him or them, we've really spoke in terms of timeline rather than academic milestones. And what I mean by that is I tried to keep the conversation more on like, you know, I expect or anticipate my graduation or anticipated graduation date to be May of 2017, say. In setting that sort of firm timeline fairly early on, it gave me a lot of, you know, opportunity to say what I could continue to take on, what I need to set aside and leave, you know, for someone else. An answer to that question that people will always ask you even when you tell them not to, which is, so when are you finishing?
You can use the question, so when are you finishing, to manifest your desired graduation date by just telling your PI like, hey, August of next year, clock running out.
Yeah, okay. That's what I did.
I think students are scared to do that, but I don't think they should be, because as Kayla said, the expectation of a faculty is that they will graduate students.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think I had a little bit of a leverage here in that I finished my first paper quite a bit before when I graduated. And having that, you know, paper on deck means that you have, you know, completed the expectation of graduate school. You know, a lot of people will say, you know, like, get your paper, get out, right? So having that finished earlier rather than later gave me a lot more leverage to be able to have that conversation and dictate my timeline myself. And I realize that's like, you know, a lucky opportunity, but it is, you know, the way that I manage my experience.
I can see how you might feel like you have some negotiation space, but even with your paper out, I mean, the expectations on like how many papers and when aren't always clear. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you had to negotiate any other goals besides just that you're going to try to leave at X time? Or did you feel like your PIs were pretty okay with you?
That's a good question. I feel like I don't know how comfortable I am giving this as advice, but what I ended up doing was overpromising and under-delivering, which the normal advice is to do the opposite. And so I don't think this is great advice, but what I did was I kind of prioritized on the things that I really wanted to finish first and told my PI that, you know, I would get to these other things that he wanted me to do if I had time. And some of the things I finished and they turned into a paper, and some of the things I didn't, and they're still in limbo as far as I know. The reason that that was sort of allowed to happen was because I set this timeline and date so early in advance that when the time came, I was just out and these sort of things are kind of passed on. The other thing is, you know, of course, if you have a job or an opportunity lined up, that is another bargaining chip that you can use to try and get your, you know, set your timeline to your terms.
So let's talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I would say that having a job lined up is a great tactic if you have a toxic mentor. And if it's your only way out, just get a job. Yep. Easier said than done, though.
Like, when did you start looking? Like, how far out from your end date mm-hmm. did you start looking? And was that, in retrospect, a good amount of time?
I started looking for my job the first time around, when I was interested in industry and ended up going to a postdoc, I started looking like 2 months before I finished. In retrospect, that was a terrible idea. That is nowhere near enough time to do what you need. Like the interview process can take 3 to 4 months sometimes. So that was extremely unrealistic, and I was lucky that I managed to find a postdoc position so quickly. The next time around, I actually was in a sort of lucky position to have a company, you know, talk to me and ask me if I was interested in potentially leaving to join them as a scientist. This was at the end of my second year of grad school, or postdoc, second year of postdoc. And when they approached me, they were like, you know, I had worked together on a collaboration with them. They would like to continue the project internally. Would you like to come and join us? And at the time, I didn't feel ready to leave my postdoc yet. I felt like I hadn't gotten as much as I wanted to out of it. So I told them no, and I told them I'd come, you know, get back in touch with them a year later. However, it was during the time I started, you know, that was when I started thinking about where I wanted to go, what I wanted to do, and what sort of job I was envisioning. So over the next year, I wasn't applying, but I was emailing people and asking for informational interviews. I feel like this is a tool that everyone tells you to use, and I'll talk about it a little too, which is that for some reason, whatever reason, when people have a job that, you know, they either like or don't like, they really love talking about it. Like, they really, really love just, like, bending your ear with whatever is going on in their life and how things work for them. So it was actually way easier to get those informational interviews than I thought. I have that natural impulse to be like, you know, oh, I'm being a bother, I'm being a burden on them, but they seem to really enjoy it. But it wasn't until about August of my last year as a postdoc that I started looking for a job, and I finished my job search after about 6 months. That felt like it actually concluded fairly fast. I only interviewed at maybe about 3 positions total. But 6 months, you know, gave me a lot of time to go through the process and, you know, look at different companies and not feel too rushed. And I think, you know, that the timeline can extend from 6 to a year.
How much did your PIs help you in that process?
They didn't. They didn't.
Okay.
My PI was very supportive, but he didn't have very much to offer. And I find that this tends to be a common thread with some people I've talked to, which is that if your PI doesn't have close ties to industry already, usually in the form of starting a company or being on advisory boards for a couple of different, you know, places, their world is fairly academic for obvious reasons. And so I was not able to get a lot of strong introductions from my PI. I had a couple of folks, alumni from the lab, who were willing to chat with me. But none of those led to the position I have currently.
What networking did you rely on? Were you mostly relying on reaching out for informational interviews in the past, or were there any networks that you had built up through conferences or, like you mentioned, collaborations? Like, what did you lean into?
I leaned on the networks of my peers, actually. Mm-hmm. The place I did my postdoc was a very small institute, a few hundred people total. So you get to know people fairly closely. And so I relied on people who are my friends, either in my lab, in neighboring labs, people that I had, you know, bumped into or taught how to use a machine or help with some data analysis, you know, those people that you kind of build up incidental connections with over the course of your research career were really instrumental to me. A lot of them would be able to, or had at least some contact with the people I wanted to talk to, or could at least point me to someone who might know. And I felt like that ended up being a big help for me, especially in some of my early interviews that didn't pan out, but were really exciting anyway. In addition to that, I felt like the collaboration network I had built up as well via, you know, an industry collaboration during my postdoc, which I recognize is not a common thing to do. But if you have an opportunity to work together with industry, that can be also a really strong foot in the door. And I ended up using one of those industry contacts as one of my references for my position now. I didn't rely on conference contacts very much, though, partially because I'm not very good at networking at conferences, and partially because due to COVID and the fact that, you know, my first couple of years I was starting a new project, I didn't go to any conferences for a little while. So that circuit had gone kind of cold by the time I was searching.
I would absolutely echo the value for job hunting and other ways in your career, like, at least for me personally, the people who give me the best insight are what I would think of as like peers who are 2 or 3 years ahead. So they're close enough to your situation that they know where you're coming from, but they also like are further along and can relay like key information or context. Like Sarah, you're a few years ahead of us in our PhD program. You hooked me up.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I'm glad to hear that I was helpful. And I think that that's definitely true. You know, people who are close enough to remember to struggle, but not so far that, you know, they're completely.
If they're removed. Like, oh, back in my day, you just had to write a Nature paper and then you got a faculty for tenure.
And you bought a house on your stipend.
Listen, you can still do that in the Midwest. Shout out.
So, tell us, industry versus academia, you've done both. Mm-hmm. Is the grass greener on the other side?
Oh boy, it's greener in one sense.
I can guess which sense.
Money.
It's money.
Thanks,
they pay, they pay so much better. So I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is not a cheap place to live. It was actually a big consideration for me in terms of, you know, being able to go into academia versus industry. But aside from the obvious, in industry is very different. It's much less homogeneous than academia was. In academia, when you go around and, you know, join different labs or join different institutes, the experience is fairly similar in that, you know, you're working towards your paper, you're trying to think of interesting research questions that other people have not asked before, but are not too new so that they're completely outlandish. Everyone is looking to the NIH for funding. You know, it follows a very predictable structure. In industry, it's much, much broader, the kind of experiences you have. And it can be exciting and also a little exhausting. It's hard to define it as like one thing, really.
Can you speak to one of the downsides of academia is that people often work really long hours, mm-hmm. and maybe to the point of diminishing returns. Has that been your experience in industry?
I think it depends. In my personal experience, it has not. So I was speaking to a friend recently, but what we said was our experience in industry is that we work less hours, but we work much more intensely, you know? And it's not like, you know, you're tissue culturing harder, but there are many demands on your attention and your time and people who want to talk to you. You know, my calendar is usually 20 to 30 hours of meetings a week, which is scary, but it is, you know, a very different experience from grad school or your postdoc. And one thing I want to bring up, especially that I think is really important, is that it's very, very, very easy to fall into imposter syndrome when you leave. What I mean by that is when you're in academia, you have a tendency to work more than 40 hours a week, sometimes 60, sometimes 80, you know, depending on where you are. And when you make the transition to industry, that number drops drastically. And so for a very long time, you feel super unproductive because you're, you know, you have half the amount of time to do, you know, what your brain is thinking, you know, the same amount of work to feel productive. So there is a huge shift in your perceived productivity that can make you feel, it can make you feel like unproductive and lazy, but it's really more of the fact that you're working like a normal person and a healthy number of hours.
Yeah. Since I'm newer to industry, I can definitely speak to that. Like when I first started, I was like, wait, people here really only work 40 hours a week. And like, I never get emails on the weekends or at night. And I also don't get a barrage of emails at 8:02 AM indicating that they just delayed send them overnight / the weekend. So one thing that has helped me reframe about working culture is like, if you meet a grad school student who says, I had a great time at grad school. I worked really hard. It took me 10 years to graduate. People would be like, huh, wonder what was up with that situation. Right. But when you meet a grad student who's like, oh, I was working really hard. I was working 100 hours a week. It's like, that's the same thing. You're still working twice as much time mm-hmm. for the mm-hmm. same PhD. Yeah, that thinking about it like that has really helped me to reframe. And yeah, working time in industry, much more intense, much more efficient and productive.
Yeah, definitely.
So what pushed you to go into industry at the end of the day?
Actually, I did want to mention one thing to the last point real quick.
Oh, yeah.
Which is that the experience does differ. So, and I think one of the big differences in industry that you'll find is that there's a huge difference between a startup and an established company. And that many of the things I am saying need to be taken in the lens of, I work for Genentech, which has been here, you know, since the beginning of biotech. And things that are true for me may not be true for like a 1 to 2 year old startup with 5 employees. So to the question of what pushed me into industry, so the field I work in is tissue engineering and stem cell engineering. And it's a super interesting, very vibrant, and quickly moving field where we are working on all kinds of different models that recapitulate different aspects of, you know, human biology, of development, and complex structures that we never thought we'd be able to make in a lab. The problem with that is, you know, people are so excited to build all these different models and make all these different things that there's a lot of people who are building and not a lot of people who are actually using. We have a plurality of hammers in the field. So the position I found here, or rather the reason I was looking at industry to begin with, is because I really wanted to be a part of something that took the hammers and actually went and applied them to some nails. I wanted to move into the space where we weren't just thinking about potentially useful applications and actually applying them. And it's rare to find that sort of experience in academia, but, you know, in industry, it's bread and butter.
I'm so glad you said that. I think that's a really great point.
We make a lot of stuff, but how much of it gets implemented?
Right.
So when you think about your job hunt, and was there any like concrete, besides of course networking and like using the resources that you know to make the connections that you need, was there any, do you have any like concrete job hunting or interview tips that you'd like to share? Like anything that worked really well for you? For me, I can share that like writing CV and cover letter was a journey. And when I read back at like my first CVs and cover letters that I sent out, it's like as cringe inducing as like reading my undergrad college application essay. It's like, ooh. So that was one for me, like learning how to write those well was really helpful. Was there anything for you that was really like, I wish I had known this at the beginning?
Yeah. And part of this is motivated actually by the fact that we are, like, I've been involved in some of the hiring here and have gotten to see it from the other perspective. So a lot of what I would say that I wish I had done or wish I had known is how people who are hiring will view the things I give to them and how they, what lens they're putting in front of their eyes to try and understand what I'm giving to them. This can be simple things like the very standard tip of keep your resume to 2 pages or less. People will look at it for 15 seconds and then move on to the next one and realizing how true that was. The importance of changing your resume for each position, not in terms of, you know, adding things or, you know, fabricating stuff, but in terms of organization. You can highlight different things that you know how to do depending on who you're talking to or what they're looking for. And so all of this kind of ties into what I would say, like my biggest advice is read the brief really, really carefully because they will tell you everything they're looking for in there. And if you feel like you're a good match, really highlight all the ways in you which you are a good match. When I was looking for jobs, I spent a lot of time sending out, you know, the same cookie cutter resume, fairly similar cover letter to a lot of different jobs and none of them called me back. It wasn't until I really stopped and spoke to some of my colleagues here and got their help in rewriting my resume and writing a new cover letter every time, which killed me to do, that people started paying attention. And it was really because, you know, I got to think carefully about what they were looking for and really illustrate what I could bring to fulfill that need.
Yeah. I mean, I started thinking, one thing that was really helpful for me to reframe this was thinking about the job description as a rubric and imagining someone that doesn't have a deep expertise on your field, be able to look at the job description and then look at your resume and just match the different points and things that to you might be synonyms to a person from HR might not be synonyms. So you have to really spell it out and use the same language and match it up.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you talk about some of just logistically applying for an industry job versus an academic postdoc, big differences, things that surprised you, anything like that?
Sure. So one thing that surprised me about the postdoc actually was how similar to how I said the industry is not very monolithic or similar, postdocs are not like that either. Some people for like a postdoc position, they want you to make an application and like treat it like a job application. For the postdoc I actually ended up joining, my advisor sent my postdoc PI a email. I went across the bay to Gladstone that same week. I gave a 1-hour talk, met with, you know, half of the lab and got an offer like the next Monday. So the whole like process from introduction to finish for that postdoc took about like 4 days. This can, of course, differ between different, you know, groups, but it's very freeform because it's only just a lab that's doing it.
I'm so glad you bring this up because also when looking for a postdoc, I would ask people, what was your experience like looking for a postdoc? Like, what should I be doing? And every story was some version of, I did this random event and then I met this random person and then they talked to this other random person that I happened to know. And so then they introduced me to this PI who offered me a job and then I applied.
Yeah. It was very like that.
Yeah. But anyway, any other things that really surprised you that was different?
Yeah. So on the industry side, to my surprise, and I don't know how typical this is, the position I got, I did not actually get there via networking. It was actually a cold resume drop on LinkedIn. And that just went all the way through.
Round of applause. A real winner.
Rare. It's like won like the lottery or something here.
Well, no, it's a sign of your compelling cover letter and appropriate CV. And of course, depth of expertise and experience.
Yeah, I think it really speaks to the power of writing to the brief. That's what I tell my undergrads now is, you know, you should really strive your best to, as you said, you know, use that as a rubric and write to what they want. So for the industry process, it was the opposite of my postdoc in that my postdoc was very quick and painless. The industry application, you know, from when I dropped my application on LinkedIn, that was around October. It took 2 months, which is relatively short for this lab, I understand, for me to get like an actual offer, even though I could start immediately. So, and in that time, there were like five like talks or like meetings between me and the hiring manager, followed by like a very long job talk and a day of meetings with everyone in the group. So the industry application was pretty intense. It felt a lot like what people say like a faculty job talk is like.
Yeah, and I would say, at least on my side, because you're not always being hired to do exactly what you did in your postdoc or your PhD. So for industry job talks especially, it's all about your communication and not using jargon and breaking it down for the audience and bringing them with you as you tell the story, rather than just like for some faculty talks where they like assume that you already know about like the pro con of QT, PCR versus whatever, you know, like keep it, at least for me, it's successful to keep it more high level in industry, which is a skill in and of itself, right?
I would definitely agree with that because also in industry, people think about things a little bit differently too. In academia, I think we're trained very much to think about very deeply about the ramifications of like choosing a particular assay or, you know, how this ties into like an overall much, you know, bigger overarching picture. But in industry, it's a little bit more cut and dry. You know, they're looking for yes, no answers to a battery of different questions about how they design or get to an end goal, right?
And the end goal is like the business needs. So I got a lot of questions around things like, if this was a company, would you have continued with this project? And I would be like, unfortunately, no, you know? So be ready for, I don't know, at least in my experience, that's been.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to say was, I really like your point about communication. And I will add on as a very specific potential, like additional tool in your belt, is you'll find often that when you're trying to give a talk that is a little more broad, a little bit more high level and trying to be approachable for multiple people, that it's, you know, compelling to people who may not know a lot, but you will occasionally have interspersed in your audience people who know way more than they should. And they will ask questions or they will grill you. And it's important to be able to perform that act of, I don't know the best word for it, maybe code switching between, you know, someone who is speaking in like a lay capacity versus someone who's speaking as a deep expert in your field. And knowing when to do that and who exactly you need to do that to is an important skill in that communication and one that you're going to find tested when you do these talks.
Oh, for sure. They'll make sure to get a subject matter expert of your subject in the room.
Usually someone who likes to flex a little bit too.
You don't have to look hard to find someone, a scientist that likes to flex. Industry or academia alike. They're always among us.
What was it like going through these two job searches personally? How did you not get discouraged? Was there anything that really affected your job searches?
Yeah, it's really easy to get discouraged in the thick of it because so much of what you do ends up just disappearing into the void. Of the 25, 30 different applications I sent out, I think I heard back from maybe about like 4 of them total, of which 3 of them turned into no's. So the odds of success here in any capacity is it's like similar to starting a new experiment. You know, it is an exercise in repeated failure. So what I found was really helpful to me is finding people either in my lab or close by that were about the same stage of their career and just sharing experiences and talking to them about what I was going through. Because as people are also going through this process, you know, you really need to lean on them for support, but also really lean on them too, because some of them will have, you know, good insight or recommendations for you. A friend of mine, actually, during my job search, she interviewed for a position, got rejected, but realized that it would be a perfect fit for someone else in her lab, and actually managed to get that person the job by introducing them to the company. And so this is kind of a way of continuing to network, where you can get the emotional support you need and the confidence to keep going from people who are in the same boat, but also they can offer you, you know, benefits, like real tangible benefits beyond just, you know, caring for your mental health. Okay, so there is one thing I wanted to mention, which is I think that for a woman especially, there is a lot of difficulty and pressure at this particular juncture in your life because the pressure to make a decision about family around this particular time. And I guess I will preface a little by saying that I cannot speak super well to that because I am a trans woman in a lesbian relationship. Children or family building is not anywhere in our future. So I managed to avoid a lot of that. But instead, I want to talk a little bit about maybe a rarer perspective, which is a perspective of someone who transitioned while on the job search and while looking around. When I first met you, Kayla, and when I was in my PhD program, was before I had transitioned and before I was out as trans. And first of all, the experience you have with other scientists is very, very different, just like everyone will say. It was a real shock to see that all, you know, rotate over so quickly after transitioning. Well, one of the things that was really important to me when I was looking for my postdoc lab and when I was looking for a job was to find somewhere that was supportive or at the very least not hostile to me being who I was. So I chose a postdoc lab that had a fairly sizable, you know, LGBT presence at an institute that was known for having a small contingent at Pride every year and generally being, you know, open and welcoming of people of all identities. So after I came out, when I was at, during my postdoc, when I was doing my job search, I actually made a decision to be open about my identity on all my applications. I would include it, you know, wherever I could. I didn't put it on my resume or cover letters or anything, but I would slide it into some of the demographic information, for example, because I wanted to, you know, maybe self-select a little bit for organizations that would not bat an eye or who would be okay with that sort of thing. And I realize this is sort of like a depressing reality these days because, you know, you have to be so careful. But for me, it was very important, and I think that it may have slowed down my search, but it meant I was happier in the end.
Yeah, it totally makes sense that you want to find an environment that's supportive. Did you mentioned some of the ways that you did this. Did you mostly have an idea ahead of time just based on past personal experiences or maybe people that you knew? Or was there any place that you were kind of cold screening almost? And how did you go about that?
Yeah, so this was, so in terms of like their response or their willingness to accept, mm-hmm. This is actually a large part of why I didn't go with a startup. Startups generally, by nature, they have less people. And so the odds of them having a diverse population in there or enough people where questions about identity and about supporting trans or gender nonconforming, you know, individuals, they don't naturally occur. And because of that, you know, there's very rarely a system in place to support or understand them from an administrative perspective, but also from a social one. Even Gladstone, the place I did my postdoc, when I was in the process of deciding whether I wanted to come out there, and talking to people, I think we had only seen like one additional like trans individual in the past like however many years of current living memory. There were a lot of smaller companies that I would use that as a method to like hold screen, as you said, or to get, you know, an idea of, or at least put that in there so that I could be open about it because that was what I wanted to do. But I did feel like a lot of these companies that are smaller, you know, often don't have that particular, you know, type of representation. And it means that, you know, their ability to support or willingness to support or even ignorance about issues like this is fairly limited by comparison.
And then since being there, do you feel like it has indeed been supportive?
I can say that Genetec's been like super, super supportive. Mm-hmm. So for a variety of reasons, to get into some personal details, I'm trans, but I have not been able to change many of my legal documents due to family reasons. And Genetec has been extremely accommodating of that. They have actual HR and IT systems in order to allow you to use your chosen name in almost every capacity possible, except on like your W-2. And that has made a tremendous difference in my comfort there and my feeling of belonging and my feeling of, you know, like a well-being. And it means that when I'm looking at other companies right now who are potentially reaching out, because once you're at Genetec, people reach out to you all the time and they're like, hey, do you want to be poached for somewhere else? A lot of them, I look at them and I'm like, I don't think that you'll support me in the same way. And I'm very cold on you because of that. In addition to the fact that I don't want to leave.
I think that's a really excellent example that you provided of how Genetec does something that's like not that hard, but like really has a huge impact on your well-being and your desire to stay employed. And, you know, retention of mm-hmm. talent is very, you know, that's a metric for them. Are there other things that you that are great at Genetec or that you wish you had had in the past or that you wish you had now that could further elevate your experience as a trans woman, both now and, you know, during your transition process or even before you transition, things that institutions or individuals can keep in mind in order to, you know, create a more welcoming environment, both for the people that are already there and the people that they're trying to recruit?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that Genetec does very, very well that I found that, you know, even places that are relatively progressive or have a strong system of support in place are not always great about is LGBT healthcare. So the reason for this is because, you know, overall, we know much less about LGBT health than we do heteronormative cisgender individuals' health needs. But also because, you know, some of the unique needs or some of the oddities of having these separate requirements don't often pop up in the heads of people who are designing programs or who are, you know, thinking about the cost benefit of what insurance to offer people and that sort of thing. And so one issue I had, for example, was even at Gladstone, which is, you know, they're very supportive and you know, positive towards people of all walks of life. I had a lot of trouble with my health insurance when I was there, getting things like hormone replacement therapy or even routine blood work covered because the insurance provider did not cover gender-conforming care. That was considered like a little bit outside of the scope of the plan. And so I ran into this issue where I would have blood work done and, you know, the blood work panel would include like hormone measurements. And because of that, they'd be like, oh, this is trans blood work. It's not covered. So routine blood draws would often end up, you know, costing a lot. And eventually they got it fixed. You know, I raised complaints and talked to a lot of people and had that changed. But having to go through that when you're already working many hours a week as a postdoc and having the burden of like that thrown on you as someone on a postdoc salary was pretty stressful. And Genetec offers, you know, both really comprehensive health insurance that's never given me any issues with that, but also they have their own, I think it's a small startup or a small company that does catalogs LGBT-friendly health providers. So people who are specialized in reproductive health or hormone replacement or surgeries or like the special surrogacy needs of gay parents, and makes that available to their employees because there is, you know, as I'm sure any queer person out there will probably know, there is a lot of fear about going to see a new doctor and what they're going to say and how awful they're going to be about who you are. It's not something that you can really tell ahead of time. And so the director that they've contracted is, you know, it's really something special. And it was something very informed about health issues that I haven't seen in many other places.
Wow, that's awesome. And I would say, I read the other day about how fertility, like, people don't usually stay at a job or leave a job because of the health insurance benefits, right? Like, it's usually considered like something that you deal with or benefit from if it's bad or good. But one area where people will stay at a job or actively seek a new job is to get coverage for infertility. And I think, you know, gender affirming care probably falls into a very similar category where someone in that situation would like stay in the job for that benefit or would seek a new job because it has that benefit.
Absolutely. I definitely agree with that. And I mean, like, to be perfectly honest, people will often turn to, you know, any means necessary to get that sort of care. And so, you know, something like leaving a job is definitely, definitely small change compared to, you know, some of the other things people will do.
Another question that I had, which you don't need to answer if you don't have anything to say about it, but another question that I wanted to bring up was, did you have difficulty, since you mentioned that your transition was during your postdoc, but I know you have a lot of amazing publications from your PhD, which were published under your dead name. So how was that another place where you felt like you had to disclose, or were you able to work with the journals to adjust the name on the publication?
This is such an important question for so many reasons. So actually, it depends on the journal, is been my experience. Some journals are much more open to it, and some are much more resistant. The good thing about many journals is that they do have a procedure in place for this sort of thing. It's the normal issuing a correction to an article can be also used for, you know, changing your name. So when you submit a request, you'll often say, like, I'd like to submit a request for a correction to the article and ask for the name to be changed. Many of them are, your mileage may vary, but I did find that, you know, this is one of those points where I felt like there was, as a field, maybe not that much support and a lot of difficulty in making it work. For me, it wasn't so bad because I didn't have that many publications before I transitioned. And also, you know, some of them were like bottom, like, you know, my name was buried somewhere in a long author list. So I didn't feel too strongly about having the wrong name in there. The other thing I wanted to mention is that I think there are many internet resources these days that actually help a lot. So things like Google Scholar or ORCID, OrcID, these electronic records of your authorship and your papers have been really, really helpful because you can curate that yourself. So for example, if you look up my ORCID, you'll find papers with both my real name and my dead name on there because I managed to put them together. It's not ideal to have my dead name there. I hate seeing it every time, but it means I don't lose credit for them.
Yeah, I think, thank you for sharing. I think that's great for everyone to know, both for people, you know, considering transitioning, as well as for people learning about the scholarship of our trans colleagues and being able to identify the work that they've published throughout their career.
Or any neat reason someone would have to change their name.
Yes, like marriage, divorce, someone whose name had a typo. much less emotionally serious, but still.
I've had that happen. Oh. Anyway, what's one project that you're really excited about right now?
In my hands, things I'm doing?
Sure. I hadn't even thought of the possibilities not in your hands. I just assumed.
Let's see.
Are you thinking about how you can describe what you want to say without saying anything that you can't reveal confidentially? Because this has been a hurdle for me in the industry.
I am, to some degree. But one of these I think we've presented, so I think it may be okay.
We can use some analogies, you know.
Some analogies? Okay. Okay, there is a project going on here at Genentech that I'm very excited about. So I am involved with our company's D&I efforts. So our efforts to, you know, improve our accessibility and the healthcare we provide and its relevancy to, you know, all people. And so if you look at the composition of cells that we use in biology, you'll find that, like many things in this world, they're overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male. Surprise, surprise. So there's a project going on at Genentech right now. It's a biobanking project to collect patient samples from, you know, healthy donors and to create archives of, you know, certain tissues from people of varying ethnicities, socioeconomic backgrounds, sex and gender, for the purposes of scientifically performing experiments or doing research on a diverse in vitro population. So rather than thinking of it at, like, you know, a clinical scale or, like, you know, big, like, you know, population level GWAS studies, this is taking it, you know, from that, the societal level and putting it back into a dish. So we can make these sort of discoveries without, you know, requiring people take risks in clinical trials or provide genomic information that, you know, to large databases, but actually be able to do it, you know, in vitro. I think that's really exciting, and I'm really excited for this to build and for us to be able to start asking questions about the diversity of human life and make drugs that are good for everyone.
That sounds like a really exciting project.
Mm-hmm. That's super cool.
Yeah. And I have to keep tabs on where this goes. Is it time?
You know what? I think it might be. I think it is shameless plug time.
Our favorite time of this podcast. Shameless plug time is where you get to share anything that you would like to shamelessly plug. Past examples have included favorite TV shows, surf instructors, lipstick, upcoming research talks, or new companies. So, you know, just pick whatever, you know, you would like to shamelessly plug.
Okay. This one is relevant for people who are in the kind of biotech world of the Bay Area. But if you're ever in South San Francisco or Oyster Point or anywhere of those, like, you know, where many, many biotechs in NorCal are, go a little bit down the road on Grand Avenue and there's a restaurant called Mom's Korean Tofu. And it is the best Korean food I've been able to find outside of LA. It is amazing. And I really want you to go there because I shudder at the thought of them ever closing. They're a new business. So I want to support them in any way I can. Please help me continue to get my Korean food fix.
I love this. It's concrete, awesome. It's specific. I'm here for it. Great plug.
I'm a little bit sad that I'm not in the Bay Area to support this restaurant.
Yeah. And speaking of, as someone who lives in Orange County, so like I could go to LA, but I have to have a good reason. So what Korean restaurant should I go to in LA to be my reason?
Oh, just go to K-Town. Go anywhere.
Okay. Go anywhere. Okay.
The bar is so high over there.
Yeah. Okay.
But cool. This place is also it's a mom and pop story too.
Love to support.
When they say Mom's Korean Tofu, they actually mean it.
That's awesome.
I just picture there's a mom cooking.
There is, and a grandma, and mom's husband.
Oh, wow.
The family business. Wow.
Literally family business.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I hope all your colleagues at Genentech will listen to this and then just jaunt down over there.
I hope so. I know a lot of them listen.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for being with us here today. It has been an honor to host you on our podcast, and thank you for everything that you've shared.
You are very welcome. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. And
if you liked this episode, or if you know someone who could use this episode in their life, just put it in the DMs, you know, drop it in the chat, and share the story of Double Shelix with the ones you love.
Thank you, listeners. Until next time.